All right. It's a Monday morning. It's gloomy out there. And it's going to rain all week. How's that feel? It's because Rick Howe's on vacation. Let's blame him. God does not like Rick Howe. It gives him bad weather. Joining me here in studio is Rob Thacker. It is time for Science Files. And he is an astrophysicist. Does anybody spell physicist? I bet most people couldn't spell physicist. What do you think, Rob?
I think they could. Huh?
You think they could?
Yeah.
He's also the director.
I'll take it spelt with an F if you want. I don't mind.
There you go. He's also the director of the Science Outreach Center at St. Mary's University. That's also correct, isn't it?
That's correct. Yeah.
Wow, we're on a roll here, aren't we?
Yeah, no, it's good. Let's keep going.
So we have Rob in to answer your science-related questions, and there's a few things that we can talk about as well. Give us a call. What do you have on your mind when it comes to science-related stuff? See if you can stump this guy. 1-877.
Oh, they can stump me easily. They regularly do.
877-801-8255 or 902-405-6000. I have a quick one for you, okay?
All right.
Oil.
Yep.
We are extracting oil. Is that the right term? Extracting or drilling for oil, whatever it is. We're taking oil out of the ground at rapid millions and millions of barrels a day. Do we know the number? What would the number be?
That's actually quite followed. I couldn't tell you off the top of my head.
Right.
I mean, I know
tens of millions of barrels a day, safe to say.
I know there is. So in the oil sands, there's potentially trillions of barrels in terms of in the total reservoir.
Yeah.
But on a day-to-day basis, I couldn't tell you what the number is. But it's millions of something.
Okay. How do they know how much oil is in the ground?
It's estimated, right? But you can go around and you can look at the geology and then you can estimate roughly how big reserves are. It's like I just said for the oil sands. That is an estimate. You can't measure these things perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, based upon what we know from the geology of previous deposits, you can go and look at the ones that we haven't yet mined and then estimate. There was a theory due to a guy called Thomas Gold, who was an astrophysicist, who thought that there might perhaps be really, 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 really deep deposits of oil that were basically put there when the Earth was made up in the very early stages of the solar system. But that's largely discredited now. We think that most of the oil that we have on the Earth really is left over from basically material getting converted into oil over time.
Okay. Not a finite resource. Nothing on Earth is finite, is it?
Nothing on Earth. Well, no, everything on Earth is finite.
Right.
Right. So, okay. I mean, there's a limit to everything on the Earth.
Yeah, right. I apologize.
It's the atmosphere, whether it's
misspoke.
Oil, whatever.
Right. Yeah. So no matter what the resource is, so we hear peak oil. Have we hit peak oil?
If you look at the numbers, we're pretty close to it, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So peak oil means you've used more than what's left in the ground. Is that a layman's term of putting that?
That's the peak extraction, and then I believe the two are linked, that we are hitting peak extraction, which basically says at that point we really are starting the downward curve.
Okay. So here's where I'm going with this. We're not talking global warming here because of climate change, but you're displacing this mass that's in these caverns in the ground.
Yep.
And I don't know what the weight would be, but I would think it would be an astronomical weight that this oil is in its composition in the ground. You take it out of the ground, you burn it in an internal combustion engine, and it releases into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
The term equilibrium, even a dummy like me knows what equilibrium is. That Earth's on an exact rotation and an exact axis, and the way that it interacts with gravity and the sun and all that, is there the potential to displace that equilibrium in some way by taking all of this from that's embedded in the ground and burning it and removing it and displacing it? Is that potentially an issue?
No. So the first thing...
Is it at least a good question?
Well, because the first thing that you hinted at was actually really quite good, and that's what happens to the ground when you take the oil out.
Right. Yeah.
And so there are situations where oil extraction has led to things becoming more unstable, and there are certain situations where we know pumping groundwater into things has also created minor earthquakes and stuff like that. So you can actually, yes, when you take things out of the ground, destabilize it. But in terms of the overall mass in all of those tons of oils, you got to remember that the Earth is so much, 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 much bigger than that, that it's really a fractional thing at the end of the day, and it really doesn't have a big impact. Although we're not talking about climate change, that is a much bigger impact on the overall sort of like ecosystem than taking oil out of the ground and putting it in the air and changing what we would call the moment of inertia of the Earth.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So we don't have to worry that the oil is not going to create the Earth to go spinning off its axis.
It's definitely not going to stop the Earth spinning.
At least we can eliminate that disaster. Because that's been on my mind, I got to be honest with you. So what
I mean, the Earth's axis is moving all the time. I mean, there's what's called the precession of the Earth's axis. So the pole star changes over tens of thousands of years.
Right.
And the climate changes a little bit because of that as well.
Okay. And what about any number of mining of any all natural resources combined, whatever it might be, because there's a ton of extraction going on all the time. Never a fear of that, then? We can completely put that away forever?
You can. You can rest well, Tom. You can rest well. And it's just because the mass of the Earth is so incredibly huge.
Big,
Even if you take something like Everest and move that somewhere else, you're not going
not
to actually
displace
change
it.
The
Excellent.
Overall
Good.
Mass
I have
of the
finally
Earth.
Something I can scratch
right?
off
and
my
remember,
list.
Remember, all of that mass is not going off into space or anything like that. It's still on the atmosphere and so on. So
Got it. Okay. We're going to get into some phone calls. You up for that?
Absolutely.
877-801-8255 or 902-405-6000. Brian, you will have the first question. How are you today?
I'm excellent. Thank you very much for taking my call.
You got it.
Dr. Rob, my question actually has four parts to it.
You're starting me on the easy ones. Okay.
So this is easy. Well, it might be easy for you if it's not easy for me.
Well, we'll see.
I want to talk about those little probes that they're supposed to be sending to Alpha Centauri. They're only supposed to be tiny.
Yeah.
What propels them? That's the first question. Second question is what powers it to be able to send the signal back, and how can something so small send the signal back that we can receive from 4 light years away? And last question is, can it be upscaled to put people inside?
Right. Okay. So you'll be interested to know that two of those questions are questions that I have as well. Right. So they're good questions, in my opinion. So the propulsion for these things, that is actually the thing that I can answer straight away. So the idea with that is light, believe it or not, can put a force on things. So this actually happens in the solar system where we're trying to predict the course that an asteroid will take. Sometimes we have to take into account the impact of the pressure of the light on that object. And so if you scale that up and you use a really powerful laser, then you can actually push things really, really fast and get them up to quite close to the speed of light in some cases. So the idea with these Starshot probes, as they're called, and they're tiny, they're sort of, they say they're going to be like stamp-sized, is to literally speed them up with the pressure of the light on the back of them. And so this won't be perfect. They'll have to send many thousands of them, and a few of them will make it and so on. And then your question of what powers them, I don't actually know. I have asked that and I haven't got an answer back from colleagues as well. It might be they have a small solar cell on them, but if they have a small solar cell on them, they'll only have a tiny amount of power, which leads to the next question of how would they actually get a signal back to us? And I don't know that either, and I am wondering that exact thing too. So I don't know, because anyone who knows anything about radio transmissions in space will know that the further away you are, the higher the power you need to send that signal and to send the data. So these things, I don't know how they would get a signal back, actually, because they don't even have the sort of like parabolic dish that you need to beam a particular signal. So presumably they would be sending radio waves isotropically. That means all over the sky and in all directions, and which would need even more power. So I don't know. And can they be upscaled? In theory, I actually wrote down awful questions. In theory, you can build a starship that would be powered by a laser. And so this has been talked about quite a lot. There have been serious papers written on this, most recently in the context of, have you heard of fast radio bursts?
Yes.
So these were these signals that were detected all over the sky. In fact, a new Canadian telescope called CHIME is probably the world leader in detecting these. So an astrophysicist at Harvard called Avi Loeb actually wrote a paper suggesting, well, if you're going to build one of these starships that have this giant light sail and you shot your laser at it or radio waves at it to push it, what would you see? And he predicted you would see these kind of fast radio bursts on Earth. So it's possible it could be scaled up. Would it be something that we can do with current technology? No, we'd probably have to sort of look into it in greater detail and use materials that we don't quite have quite yet. But in theory, yes, you could scale it up.
But if things are weightless in space, why would it matter?
Things aren't really weightless in space, right? This is unfortunately a misconception that happens because as we orbit the Earth, you are actually falling towards the Earth, but you're falling around the curvature of the Earth. So you constantly keep on going.
You mean the Earth's
around.
Not flat? I saw something on Netflix which told me that it is.
Don't believe everything you see on the TV.
Brian, I got to run. Hopefully that answered your question.
I just want to say one thing.
Sure.
I stumped him with the first question.
You did. You did.
Not only did
you stump him, but he had the same question percolating in his mind. Yeah. So you're obviously on the right track, my friend. Thanks, Brian.
I'm smarter than I look.
You're SMRT, my friend. Take care. All right. Good question, though.
Yeah, absolutely. First four-part question I've ever had.
Absolutely. 877-801-8255 or 902-405-6000. We'll continue with your calls and the Science Files when we come back. We are in the midst of Science Files. The Science Files with Rob Thacker, an astrophysicist. I can't say it either. Physicist. There's no way you can say that in the morning, can you?
Not unless you've had four coffees.
No. That might make it worse. Yeah. Quick question before we go back to the phones. When you were talking about propulsion in space,
yes,
I have heard, now I'm probably way off, that the real challenge to actual physical people traveling to other galaxies, whatever it might be, that in order to do that, you have to go at a speed which in fact then starts manipulating the concept of time as we understand it and exist in it. Is that correct?
It's partially correct in as much that there's this thing called the theory of relativity, right?
Yeah. And Einstein.
Einstein, exactly. Yeah. So when you go really, really fast, time starts changing. The perception of time changes. Mm-hmm. And so in theory, if you could go fast enough, time slows down for you as you go really, really fast.
Right.
But the reality is to go from one star to another star, you could still do that at, say, 1/10 the speed of light. Things really start getting noticeable in terms of time dilation when you get up to like 95% the speed of light. It's a very sharp, sudden change.
Mm-hmm.
So at 1/10 the speed of light, you wouldn't really see too much difference.
Right.
And realistically, that's probably about as fast as you want to go because the bigger problem is space isn't completely empty. There's still material in space.
Yeah.
And if you bump into it, it's going to do
a hell of a
lot of damage.
So when Picard goes to warp 9, that's not realistic then? Is that what you're telling me?
No, you can't believe everything on TV, I'm afraid.
All right, let's go. Bob, what's your question?
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing, doctor?
Pretty good, thanks. How are you?
Did you talk to your wife and try to coax her into the show
yet?
Yeah,
she's going to come on. She's away at the moment, but she is going to come on, yep.
Oh, fantastic.
Yep.
Fantastic. That means I got to put all my questions together.
That's all right.
And Todd, great show. I think you're going to have all week, and we need a rest from Rick once in a while, too.
Well, just a rest will make you appreciate him all the more, right? Just like when your spouse goes away for the weekend, and then they come back, you're like, hey, I like you again.
That's what he thinks.
I can just hear Rick going, why, thank you, Bob.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Doctor, what I was talking about, excuse me, and Todd, you weren't there, but for the last 3 weeks, we were talking about landing on another planet and how we're going to get there and what we're going to look like. We got that straightened around. We should look normal. But also, Doctor, we talked about the gravity, and we got that straightened around.
Yep.
But you brought up the point of if we do build a big ship, the problem of building those big ships is the weight and the metals that have to be used.
Yep.
Now, I was listening to BBC, a scientist on there, and they were talking about the future. And what they brought up, and it was very interesting, was spider webs and the study they're doing on it.
Yeah.
And he claims that in the future, because spider webs are so strong and can be developed, that they're actually about three to eight times the strength of steel, but flexible.
Yep, yep.
So what I'm going to leave is what you know about it, because I don't have a computer, and you're my computer when it comes to science, and then my mind works the other way. So I'd be interested to find out, because that's, and Katie even mentioned she's seen the scorpions that put out spider webs too.
Okay, okay. So yeah, Bob, actually, this is really neat. So I've done a little bit about this. So what you're talking about is what's called spider silk. And you're absolutely right that it has a stronger strength to weight ratio than some steels, not all steels, but some steels. And it's also flexible. It can actually deform in certain ways that steels can't. But that flexibility isn't always a good thing. Sometimes you want strength as well in terms of like conforming and staying in shape. Having rigidity is the phrase I should use. So those things in particular, if you scale up a spider's web to the size of an arm or something like that, you could literally build a spider's web that would be capable of stopping a car. So those episodes of Spider-Man where he's shooting webs and stopping cars, that's actually realistic. That's how strong the material is. And so people are looking at using not exactly the same kind of spider silk, but building materials that are motivated by the structure of spider silk. In particular, one of the things it will do is there are lots and lots of strands in it, and they'll slide over one another to be kind of stretchy, but they'll reach a point at which they won't slide anymore, and then they become strong. So material scientists are actively working on that, but I don't see that having a particularly big impact on building spacecraft, but it is could potentially have a big impact on materials for clothing. It could have an impact on materials for buildings on the Earth as well. So this is something to keep an eye on, definitely. And I actually, like I said, we have talked about this on on another radio station that I'm no longer on.
Which we shall not mention.
I did a whole episode on it. So it definitely is something that's becoming more and more interesting, Bob. So keep an eye out and see where this goes.
Well, one other thing before I leave, Doctor. I go back to a long time ago, but when they told me about that they were able to create artificial diamonds, I just shook my head and said, "You're a nutcase. That's the hardest stone on Earth, and that's impossible." And yet, it's very popular today. So, and used extensively. So, nothing's impossible, I guess you put it that way.
Well, some things are impossible. Sorry, I'm a scientist, but in terms of artificial diamonds, yes. I mean, we did. I mean, I think the Russians were the first to do this commercially. And so there are a lot of gemstones made in Russia, actually, artificially, including sapphire as well. Sapphire was actually one of the first things to be made artificially. But you can make diamond. As hard as it is, they put it in a crucible, heat things up under huge amounts of pressure, and ta-da, you get diamonds.
Bingo.
Thanks, Bob.
Well, listen, Todd, you have a great week. I'm looking forward to it. And, Doctor, I'm looking forward to seeing your wife, and I've got my list ready.
You'll be hearing her. You won't be seeing her.
Take care.
That's the beauty of radio. There's no prejudice unless we don't like what you have to say.
You got it. Take care, Bob. Thanks for calling. 877-801-8255 or 902-405-6000. That's the way to get a hold of us. It is the Science Files. Rob Thacker is in the house. Just quickly, Rob, when it comes to space travel, besides propulsion and navigation and all of that, just basically sustaining human life, like the need to eat and all that goes with being a human being, that's as much of a challenge as anything, isn't it?
Oh, it's a huge challenge. I mean, we're literally traveling on a spaceship Earth, and you've got to be able to replicate all of the support things that we have on the Earth on a spaceship.
Why not drones then, but mechanized space travel? Is that
That's where we'll go first.
That's probably where we're going first.
Usually,
right?
What we do first, we send probes first.
So the ego of man having our foot on Mars or whatever, some other solar system, will be supplanted by the reality that we're dealing with.
Hey,
right?
Mars is the only planet solely inhabited by robots that we know of.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Interesting. So the Science Files continues again. Want to hear from you. I wanted to take your calls, 877-801-8255 or 902-405-6000. We'll continue with Science Files after the news. The Science Files continues with Rob Thacker, physicist, doctor. That's pretty cool. I wish I was a doctor.
This is the kind of a fake doctor, though.
So nobody have a health issue and ask for help.
That has happened a couple of times.
I'll bet. Do we have a doctor in the house?
Kind of doctor.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, and actually, that's happened on an airplane as well. So I don't fly as Dr. Thacker. Right? Because they have the passenger manifest and they come down and they say, "You're Dr. Thacker. Are you a medical doctor?" And you go, "No." And then you feel really bad about it. So I don't use that anymore.
I think the physicist, astrophysicist is cooler anyway. It's got more more cachet to it.
It certainly started off a few dinner party conversations and arguably ended some as well.
Exactly. Okay, again, toll-free number for questions for the doctor, 877-801-8255, or you can reach us at 902-405-6000. Tony, how are you?
I'm fine, Todd. Good morning. Good morning, astrophysicist. Dr. Thacker, I have a question for you concerning asteroids and meteorites.
Okay.
Over the weekend, I saw in Chicago that a meteorite had been spotted going over and had apparently burned up in the atmosphere. I'm wondering, is a meteorite an asteroid that didn't mature? I know I think I read somewhere where asteroids are sort of a afterbirth of the planet of the solar system, and now they're concerned about one. I believe it's called Bennu. It's the size of the Empire State Building. I saw somewhere. Can you tell me what all that relationship is there?
Tony, you've really answered your own questions. You got everything right. So the difference between meteor, meteorite, and asteroid is essentially a kind of. Well, this is okay. Let's do meteor and meteorite first. So, the difference between a meteor and a meteorite, a meteor is a shooting star. A meteorite is if something gets down to the ground and you find this rock, basically. And so, you're saying, well, then what's the difference between a meteorite versus an asteroid? And you kind of got it perfectly right. I mean, an asteroid is just a big clump of rock in space, whereas a meteorite is a smaller clump that gets down to the surface of the Earth. So, the short answer is, could an asteroid turn into a meteorite? Yes, it could if it hit the Earth. Right. So that absolutely could happen. And in terms of things we're worried about, the thing that I was hearing about people talking about last week was something called Apophis, which is going to get within the orbit of geosynchronous satellites, which is about 30,000 kilometers away from the Earth in about 10 years time. And that's going to be close enough that if you were just sort of outside of Halifax, away from the city lights, you could actually see this thing sort of go by at night. It won't move that quickly. But we know it won't hit us, and we're not too concerned about it. We are trying to find every single thing that we can using a network of telescopes, because the big thing, as I've talked about in the past, is you want to see something before it hits you. And so hopefully if you can see something, then hopefully you can do something about it. But actually, we are pretty confident we've got everything or most things over a kilometer in size, and there really isn't anything too risky at that scale. The more worrying things is things in the sort of like 30 meters to 100 meters across, because those are hard to see, and they could still do a fair amount of damage, like the thing that hit Russia about 5 years ago. That was probably the size of a school bus, maybe a bit bigger, and that did a fair amount of damage, a few people injured from flying glass. You only need something three times the size of that, and then you're starting to see real damage.
I see. That's exactly where I was going with this thing.
Yeah.
So, but I understand we're safe till 2135. So I imagine I'm going to be space dust by then anyway.
Yeah, we will be. Me too.
Anyway.
Yeah. Just to finish this off, the one thing I say about this, don't lie awake worrying about this too much. It's something that we have to do something about. But the probability of there being a really big impactor in the near future, I think, is very low, because we have been looking and we have found most of these things. But it's that small sort of like 10, 20, 50, 100 meter things. Those are the things we have to worry about.
Thanks, Tony. You go back to worrying about Trump.
Okay, I will. Thank you.
All right. 877-801-8255. That's the way to get a hold of us if you have questions for Rob. 877-801-8255 or 902-405-6000. Now, on that topic, again, Hollywood, and we're all products of all of that. So,
regrettably.
Yeah, regrettably, but in some ways we are. First off, there's you often hear, even if they, whatever they is, knew something was coming, we wouldn't be told, because it would create mass hysteria and panic. What's your philosophy, if you have any, on that?
I don't actually think that's entirely true if the observation was made through an observatory, because there's something called the International Astronomical Union. And whenever things are discovered, there is a circular that's sent out telling people that things have been discovered. The bigger concern I have on along those lines is if we find something with enough notice, can we actually do anything about it? Right? And right now, no.
Yeah, and that was my next question.
Yeah.
Because I watched Armageddon too.
Yeah. Oh, there are so many problems in that movie. It's like, so yeah. Here's my number one pet peeve in that movie.
Okay,
right?
Sure.
They land and there's no gravity.
Yes.
Right? And so they're kind of moving around. And then suddenly...
Bruce Willis is cool, though.
Bruce Willis is always cool. Very cool dude. Yeah. And so then they're driving around on something that has gravity and then they're trying to jump a cavern.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, guys... What's going on in this movie? Yeah. This is just so bad in so many levels.
But there was a love angle to it, and everything turned out well at the end of it. That's all that matters,
sure.
Right?
Sure, I mean, there was a hero. Is a very
There was a hero. So. There was a love story.
Yeah.
And a happy ending. What else do you need in it? You don't need to have reality based on that.
If you want people not to laugh in the movie theater, that would help.
It's called willing suspension of disbelief, I believe is the term.
So I'll tell you what I do like, though, that someone recut the trailer for Armageddon in the style of Interstellar, which was kind of a serious movie, and they recut it, and it looks like it's a really good movie.
Okay. Right? We'll see.
It's called Interstellar Armageddon. It's somewhere on YouTube. I watch it. It's a lot of fun, and it's done with all of the Interstellar music as well. And you think, wow, that could have been a really good movie. It's, of course, completely not what the movie is
not
actually
like. Not what it's
like,
about all about.
But it tells you how good editors are at sort of like putting
and
these
and one of my together. Least favorite Aerosmith songs, that love sappy song that's in Astro. I can't remember.
I can't remember either.
But it's one of those, come on, Steven Tyler, please stop. Yeah, all right, let's talk to Ken. Ken, how are you?
I'm pretty good, but I want to talk to Rob. Rob, it's Ken again.
Hi, Ken.
The asteroid.
Yeah.
The best website is a website called IntoTheBlack.com. He's on, I can't think of his name right now. I've forgotten for a bit. He's been on for a couple of years, and IntoTheBlack.com. And he says, it's next April 2020, that the asteroid is going to come by about 19,000 miles close to the Earth. You can double check that, and it's a very good website. He's up in things, especially on the SpaceX. And by the way, next week I think it is, SpaceX is doing their next launch.
Okay, thank you. I will look it up.
Thanks, Ken. 877-801-8255 or 902-405-6000. Peter, under your name, Katie wrote astrophysicist. Are you also an astrophysicist? No?
God, no.
You're not?
No, I
don't know. Katie wrote that down. I don't know.
I'm eating breakfast, so just excuse me while I swallow my bacon and eggs.
I was loving the oh, God, no.
Yeah.
Oh, God, no. Anyway, astrophysicist. That's interesting. It would be probably the oldest pure science and the oldest applied science.
So I suppose you could argue that, yes, that astrophysics is the application of physics, and astronomy was probably the thing that people would argue is the oldest science, but...
A pure science as opposed to applied.
And so everyone does often ask, what's the difference between being an astrophysicist and being an astronomer? And that's a fun question, because then I say, well, an astronomer is someone who uses the telescopes, looking in space, takes data and so on, and then the astrophysicist is the smart ass who comes along and goes, yeah, well, you see that data there, that means that this thing is happening there. And so that's what I do.
Study of the movement and
exactly.
the forces
you
behind the interstellar. Could those micro satellites or micro sensors could they be using a capacitor for a micro burst of compressed information?
My question would be, because capacitors depend upon your plate size of your plates for the energy storage, so they still wouldn't be very big, though. I mean, that
Good
would be
point.
My concern.
Anyways, I'm just showing off.
Yeah. All right.
You are an astrophysicist,
anyways,
aren't you?
There was,
Maybe
but
not.
So there was that question of astronomy. I believe that one of the first uses of it actually was probably. The powers that be at the time would have astronomers on staff so that they could kind of tell the sun, the movements of the sun and the eclipses of the moon and such like that, so that they could say to the peasants, you know, you're not building that Sphinx high enough, the gods are angry, so they're going to make the sun go dark, like when I tell it to, when I say.
Yep.
And it probably worked pretty good. And I hate to say this, I kind of think climate scientists sometimes using the same kind of idea. And as far as physics go, maybe you could comment upon the application of gravity on skyscrapers. and how it's possible for them to completely dustify in like 10 seconds. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the
call.
Well,
okay.
I'm not sure what he meant by dustify. Do you?
I think I'm guessing this is talking about 9/11.
Yeah, I was thinking World Trade Center type thing.
So with the WTC, so here's the thing about a building. Buildings are designed to be structurally strong, but what they're not designed to be able to support is sudden increases in load, right? So if you took a skyscraper and then you suddenly put a really big load on it vertically, very, very quickly, it wouldn't be able to deal with that in a realistic way. Mm-hmm. So with the 9/11 collapses, what essentially caused the sudden collapse there, other than the melting of the steel and the weakening of the steel as it got hot, was that at the particular level that the plane came in at, it basically took out all of the structural support. So as soon as that structural support at whatever floors it was basically gave way, you had the entire top one third of the whole structure suddenly mm-hmm. whoomp back down onto the bottom of the structure. And that shock is way more than that structure could survive. And that's why it just went all the way down.
So the theory that there were detonated bombs timed and all of that,
that's really unhelpful and not helping us sort of like address the issues in general. But there are conspiracy theories everywhere. Yeah. It's one of those things.
You got it. Here's an email from David asks, talk about the lunar gateway. What's its purpose? Mm-hmm. Isn't deep space exploration really just a euphemism with our current propulsion technology?
A little bit of cynicism there. I would tend to agree with you. Yep, that's right. Current technologies for propulsion are all chemical rockets, which have go as far as you can store the fuel for. Although admittedly, of course, in space, once you start going, you keep going. You mm-hmm. don't need to keep on putting energy in the same way that we do when we drive a car, because that's all the friction on the road. You have to keep putting energy in space. Once you start going, you keep going. So all of the Star Wars movies where things mm-hmm. are going, whoa, the only thing you need energy for is to change direction. Right?
That's it.
Yeah. Everything where you see them going along and the engines are always burning, that would mean they were always accelerating.
So what are you, when you fire a thruster, if that's mm-hmm. the right term, what are you pushing against in space?
Oh, so you're not really actually pushing against anything. That's a really good question. Mm-hmm. What you're doing is it's actually something called conservation of momentum, right? And so what's happening is everything kind of wants to stay in its current state of motion. So if you fire something out of the back, the bit that's at the front kind of has to go forward, right? So the whole net motion is still zero, mm-hmm. right? And so you're literally firing things out the back to push yourself forward.
Right. Yeah, it's amazing, though, because when you think about anything like a plane in the air, right, it's the wings, and it's a combination of the propulsion. And
right.
So that is an act. That is.
So wings are a lifting force.
Right.
That's correct.
Yeah.
But then you still have the jet is actually still firing, in this case, a stream of exhaust gases out at a faster rate than it's coming in. So
right.
You are still doing that same sort of concept there mm-hmm. of thrust coming from the stuff going out of the back, keeping you forward via conservation momentum. Although it's not quite the same because obviously you have drag in an atmosphere as well.
So what creates the propulsion, though?
It's the creation of the propulsion is literally, it's the nature of things not to change what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So your overall momentum, if you throw something out the back, that means you have to go forward.
I see. Right. Okay. Very, very interesting stuff.
It's a bit zen, actually.
Yeah, it absolutely is. 877-801-8255 or 902-405-6000. We'll continue with your calls for our astrophysicist when we come back. We will continue with your calls in the Science Files with Rob Thacker, who's in studio. 877-801-8255. That's the way to reach us. Or you can call us at 902-405-6000. Have a chance to hear from Janet. Janet, how are you today?
Hi, good morning. I'm doing wonderful. Thanks,
excellent.
Guys.
Thank you.
Hi. Just with your talk of the comets hitting the Earth and all of that stuff.
Sure.
I read a book years ago, and it was very, very interesting. It's called Lucifer's Hammer.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was Larry Niven and David something with a P.
Ooh, classic sci-fi.
Totally. Yeah. It's a huge book. It talks about the discovery of this comet, then it hitting, then all of the implications around the planet because it's worldwide.
Yep.
It's a wonderful story. Just thought I'd pass it on for afternoon reading.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, so one of the things that people, aside from the actual impact itself, if you have a very big object hit the Earth, then there's this potential for destabilizing the mantle and creating lots of volcanic activity as well. So one of the things that we worry about with a big impact is like the one that took the dinosaurs out, basically, was whether there were actually, in addition to the impact, all of these volcanoes triggered too.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. It talks about that. It goes into, you know, flooding and the California wiped out. And fascinating book. Fascinating
book. Great. Thank you.
All right. Enjoy your day, guys.
Thank you, Janet. Appreciate it. 877-801-8255. We've got a bit of time left. If you've got a question for the doctor, 877-801-8255, or you can call us at 902-405-6000. On exploration, do you feel that at some point the private sector will lead the way when it comes to space?
That's a really good question. It's difficult to know because a lot of the things that we do for exploration are technologically very challenging and very expensive to do. And it's difficult to see a business model in which you can create enough money to do that. Now, with Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, these are two space geeks who just happen to have billions of dollars and have set up companies that basically want to try and create a business model in which they can self-fund all the development and so on. So Musk's model is pretty clear. Going to Mars, you'll pay him $100,000 and he'll take you to Mars. And that's how he will earn his billions and billions of dollars that he needs. But he has to get to Mars first.
Right.
And that's going to be the challenge for him. And so a lot of commentators are saying that SpaceX is already starting to run out of money.
Mm-hmm.
And so the big thing that they have to do is develop their next generation rocket called the BFR rocket, which we often joke about what the F stands for, but we won't go there right now. So they need to develop this vehicle, which technologically they're making a lot of, I think, sensible choices on. They don't try and go for the most sophisticated piece of technology. They try and go for something that works, right? So they're using basically methane and liquid oxygen as their primary fuel sources. And it's going to be interesting to see whether they can deliver on this, because if they do, and they have this thing flying in, like, I don't know, probably 7-8 years, that would be most optimistic. They wanted to do it by 2023. That's not going to happen. We know that won't happen. But 7-8 years, they could produce a vehicle that's significantly better than anything NASA has, right?
Mm-hmm.
If they can do it, right? And they are doing, NASA has gone in its next generation space launch system, the SLS, they've gone for something that's very hard to engineer. It has liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen fuel. Very difficult to build rockets that work reliably for that particular technology. And they're going for that because they want to have the best engineering solution. But it may be the hardest engineering mm-hmm. solution to do as well. So there's going to be a little bit of competition to see who gets there first, I think.
Interesting.
I'm going to put my neck out on the line here and say I actually think that SpaceX may end up surprising a lot of people on this.
Excellent. John, you have a question. Go ahead, John.
Good morning, guys. Listen, Doctor, what would happen if the sun's output dropped 5%? And like a lot of people are, I asked this question last week and I didn't ask it right. If the sun's output drops, what happens to the Earth's temperature? Does it drop pretty dramatically?
Oh, 5% change. So the current oscillations are about 0.1%. So 5%, that's going to have a fairly big impact, I would think. I'm not a climate scientist, so I don't want to stick my neck out on this.
I know. There's not a lot of data on this. And you know, there's a lot of modeling going on right now where the sun cycle is going to diminish over the next 8 or 10 years. And I guess what I'm wondering is like, if the sun's output even drops 2%, 1%, that's going to, like, some guys are saying that we're going to have very long winters, no summers, that kind of thing. And I guess it's interesting that there doesn't seem to be a lot of research on this.
Well, so I would say that the people, because the primary issue that you're looking at is that the radiation that comes in is an input into all of the global climate models. So people will be able to model what happens as you change the overall levels. I mean, the sun is in its main sequence point at the moment. So it's fairly steady. It's using up its fuel. It's not going to suddenly change its luminosity by a huge amount. Right, because
right.
there's just no mechanism that we know of that could do that. I mean, even sort of something dropping into it.
You know, sorry to interrupt, but there's a lot of references about, you know, the you know, mini ice age and stuff like this. And it's interesting. I went looking for data, and there doesn't seem to be a lot around. And it's just interesting that, you know, there's a meme out there that we're entering into an ice age as opposed to climate change. And you know, we just default to climate change when, in fact, the sun has nothing to do with climate change.
Okay.
So
the largest variations I know of in stellar models are the handful of percent range, and those are for very, very active stars. I would turn this around and say this data is definitely in the logbooks of astronomers. The fact that it isn't being communicated, I don't know. It may be just because so many people in the professional field feel it's a done deal, and they're just not actually communicating that effectively. Right.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. I think some of your colleagues may be some research available for this, because I think it's important.
If
we have a variation coming, we're not prepared. Yeah. Anyway.
All right.
Thanks so much, Sean. I appreciate it. And this kind of goes back to, and we're just out of time, but this kind of goes back to this equilibrium question that I had earlier when I talked about displacement of this and that. When we're like it or not, I mean, we are at the mercy of a lot of things happening at the right time in the right proportion. And history has proven that that doesn't always happen and changes happen. That's reality, is it not?
Yep. Well, so I do know, for example, with the Maunder minimum, that was a fairly small change in the overall output of the sun. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was a fraction of a percent, right? And that led to colder than normal winters, right?
Yeah.
So we are at the mercy of what happens with the sun. But like I said, really, really, really big changes, that's not going to happen in the main sequence lifetime of a sort of fairly chill sun, right? It's kind of just going along, consuming its fuel and so on. But yes, at the end of the day, there are factors that impact the climate that are beyond our control.
Exactly. Right. Rob, it's been a real pleasure. I've enjoyed having you in here. This has been a lot of fun. The next time Rick, I sit in for Rick, and we'll do it again.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's truly appreciated. That's Rob Thacker, astrophysicist and doctor, as a matter of fact. And thanks so much to him and for everybody's calls. Great calls this segment. Speaking of calls, we've got an open hour. It's Manic Monday, your opportunity to have your say. 877-801-8255 or 902-405-6000. Your calls when we come back.